I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has impaneled a grand jury. The Trump White House has called in the Marines, or at least one highly respected Marine general, to impose order in the West Wing and to squash the constant barrage of leaks. Those leaks, however, continue at an unprecedented pace. Transcripts of phone calls with the presidents of Mexico and Australia were revelatory about the president's negotiating style. A transcript of a phone call with the head of the Boy Scouts will never be leaked because the phone call was imagined by the president. In West Virginia last night, he played hits from the campaign like Lock Her Up and reveled in the defection of a Democratic governor to the Republican Party. In Baltimore City, the city council and the mayor wrestled over plans to stem the violence on city streets. Darlene Superville of the Associated Press and Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun join me for the News Wrap right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for the Midday News Wrap. Lots to dissect in the News Wrap today. The Trump train has, by some accounts, been re-railed since the arrival of Marine General John Kelly in the West Wing, redeployed from the Department of Homeland Security to replace Reince Priebus as chief of staff. He is said to have begun imposing discipline on what many consider a chaotic and dysfunctional White House operation. So far, he's apparently received assurances from the president's daughter and son-in-law that they will report to Kelly instead of daddy. He's said to be working on stopping leaks, too, but if so, he's off to a slow start on that score. This week's leaks included transcripts of phone calls President Trump placed to the presidents of Mexico and Australia right after the election. Right after the inauguration, they reveal a man whose prowess as a negotiator is considerably less advanced than he bragged about during the campaign, and for that matter, he's bragged about during his entire business career. So on the upside, at least those phone calls actually took place. The president's continuing unsettling propensity for fabrication this week included making up an admiring phone call from, of all people, the head of the Boy Scouts. Sarah Huckabee Sanders explained in the White House briefing room that those adoring comments were in fact delivered in person, not on the phone. The Boy Scouts did issue a statement apologizing for Mr. Trump's inappropriate comments at their national jamboree, comments that were heartily applauded by many in his young audience. Speaking of fabrication, that's how the president characterized the Russia story last night in a campaign rally in West Virginia. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has impaneled a grand jury as the Russia investigation continues, and a new poll says that only a third of Americans approve of the job the president is doing. Closer to home, Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh says that she has a plan to end the horrible violence that is plaguing our city. She also says that she's got commitments from Governor Larry Hogan for upwards of $64 million to help in that effort. Mayor Pugh has not, however, revealed yet what her plan is. Community activists and city council members are demanding that she do so. There's lots more going on, so let's get to it. I'm joined today for the News Wrap by Associated Press White House reporter Darlene Superville, who joins us on the line from Washington. Darlene, thank you for your time. You've had a busy time of it this week.
Yes, every week is a busy week.
That's for sure.
Glad to join you.
Well, we are glad to have you. And Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun joins me here in the studio. She's been a writer and editor at the Sun for 30-plus years. She's currently serving on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. Jean, always good to see you. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
You are welcome to join us as well. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And to join us on Twitter, that'd be terrific, @MiddayTomHall. So, Darlene, you were with the president last night in Huntington, West Virginia. Sounds like the crowd from the tape that I saw, pretty jazzed up. How would you describe that event?
That's a fair description. His crowds are always pretty jazzed up. He tells them what they want to hear, and they just they love it, and they love him.
Is he doing these events because is there any speculation as to why he thinks these events are important? He's only going to places where people voted for him overwhelmingly, and he's going to these places, it seems, to sort of stoke up his own ego. I mean, that's one explanation for it, given that he's got so many troubles that he faces on a day-to-day basis in the White House.
And that's probably the best explanation for it. There are periods when he gets really frustrated. All you need to do is look at his Twitter feed early in the morning to see that. And he seems to do, I guess his staff has realized that he seems to do better mood-wise when he's out in front of these large crowds that are whooping and applauding and cheering and chanting for him. It really does feed his ego and makes him feel a little bit better, perhaps, about himself, given all the troubles that are swirling around him, from the Russia investigation to the lack of a legislative agenda moving through Congress and those sorts of things.
Let's listen to a little clip of the president last night at this rally in West Virginia.
The reason why Democrats only talk about the totally made-up Russia story is because they have no message, no agenda, and no vision. The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is. They can't beat us at the voting booths. So they're trying to cheat you out of the future and the future that you want. They're trying to cheat you out of the leadership you want with a fake story that is demeaning to all of us, and most importantly, demeaning to our country and demeaning to our Constitution.
And Gene Marbella, one of the other things he went on to say in regard to the Russia investigation, he says, I just hope that Darlene wrote about this morning in a piece that she posted on the AP website. I just hope the final determination is a truly honest one, which is what the millions of people who gave us our big win in November deserve. So once again, he's raising the specter the way he did in the before the election, saying that he wasn't sure the election results were going to be honest. And he sort of intimated that the election was going to be rigged. He's intimating that Mr. Mueller's investigation may be rigged. What do you make of that?
You know, he's created this atmosphere where, you know, you literally do not know what to believe. Are you going to believe your own eyes reading stories by legitimate publications, or are you going to believe what he says? That it's astonishing to me that he keeps doubling down on this Russian investigation as fake news. I mean, what's going to happen when Mueller releases an indictment or releases a report on what he's found? And he really has backed himself into a corner, calling it fake, and it's, you know, in retribution for the Democrats having lost the election. It just seems like there's nowhere for him to go once the investigation plays out.
And Darlene, what can you tell us about Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia, and his big announcement that Trump heralded before he got on the plane to go to that rally? What did he have to say, and how was that received?
That was pretty well received by the crowd there in Huntington, West Virginia, last night. Governor Justice took the stage and talked a little bit about work that he was trying to do in West Virginia, work with the legislature there, and said something to the effect that, the session had just ended and somehow the work of the legislature had hurt people, it hurt elderly people. He went through a couple of categories of different people that he felt were not helped by whatever came out of the legislative session. And then he said something to the effect of that he can no longer work with Democrats, and that today he was going to be switching his party registration to Republican. It was a little surprising to me that President Trump didn't make more of a big deal out of it. He just, when he came back to the microphone, he just simply said one sentence about it. Governor Justice was a good man, and glad to have him in the party, in the Republican Party, or something to that effect. But having covered Trump now, President Trump, for 6 months, I could certainly have seen him, you know, claiming credit for this and taking credit for it. But he didn't really do that last night.
And I guess Governor Justice had also changed his party affiliation earlier from Republican to Democrat. Now he's going back from Democrat to Republican.
That's my understanding. Yeah. So Not really as dramatic of an announcement, given the backstory there.
Yeah. What's the mood at the White House for things like the fact that Congress, both the Congress and the Senate, voted overwhelmingly to impose new sanctions on Russia? I mean, the vote in Congress was 419-3, mm-hmm. and in the Senate it was 98-2. How did the folks at the White House respond to that, you know, clear rebuke of the president who threatened to veto it, but then I think realized that that veto would be easily overruled?
Yeah, it was frustrating to a lot of people in the White House because, as you described, Congress pretty much put the president in a box on this issue, right? They sort of forced him into signing it. And if he didn't sign it, then he would have been overridden by members of his own party, which would have been very embarrassing and humiliating. So there was frustration about that, and you could also sense that in the signing statements the president put out 2 days ago when he signed the bill, referring to it as significantly flawed, saying that it contained unconstitutional elements and would hinder his ability as president of the United States to negotiate effectively with foreign leaders.
And Jean Marbella, we've got this book that Jeff Flake, the senator from junior senator from Arizona, is peddling, in which he's got some very harsh things to say about Mr. Trump. There are a lot of people on the left who are saying, well, it's only a matter of time before Republican leaders, Messrs. Ryan and McConnell and senior leaders in the Republican congressional and senatorial delegations, start distancing themselves from the president. There's polling that says that time may be a lot longer than they think. But Tom Tillis, a Republican congressman from North Carolina, and Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, along with Lindsey Graham and Cory Booker, people who are generally speaking not on the same page, have all proposed legislation to essentially prevent the president from firing Robert Mueller. So is this a sign that the Congress is stepping up to say, hey, look, you know, we're here too, and we're not going to let you get away with all this stuff carte blanche?
Yeah, I think Trump has always been sort of a singular politician. Yes, he's a Republican, but he's not really of the Republican Party. And you saw that during the primaries where he freely insulted and demeaned his fellow Republicans. And you see it in his presidency where he doesn't really have a good working relationship with Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell. And the feeling is that, of course, the congressional leadership put up with him because they were going to get what they wanted. But if it comes to a point where they aren't getting what they wanted, they didn't get the health care overhaul that they wanted, we'll see what happens in the 2018 election, Trump will not be of any use to them. So I think you might see more and more people coming out and defying him. You know, we can overstate this because Flake, as dramatic as his statements are, has always voted with Trump to date.
Yeah, he voted for the health care overall,
right,
for example.
Right,
yeah.
And so, you know, you say one thing,
Mr.
but
McCain,
in the end,
his colleague from Arizona, right, did not, you know,
yeah,
rather
yeah.
Significant.
And that was the first time, really. Previous mm-hmm. to that, he had gone along with, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. his president and his party. But, you know, I think there's a fissure there. And as it grows, I think things are going to shift.
And Darlene, another question about last night. You write in your piece this morning that you remind us that he won the state in West Virginia overwhelmingly in November, mm-hmm. partially premised on his promise to revive the coal industry. Today, of course, these figures hadn't come out last night, but today, very good economic numbers, 209,000 jobs added in July, and the unemployment rate ticked down another tenth to 4.3%. Did he make any mention of the coal industry last night or any mention of the economy and the good news that he has to talk about in that regard?
I vaguely recall that he did. There were lots of people there waving signs that said, "Trump digs coal." And at one point, he took one of the signs from somebody who was holding it and kind of waved it around himself. And he did mention something about coal exports. I think the figure that he threw out was that they have increased 60% since he's taken office. But I would need to go back and really look at the numbers myself to see if they've really grown by that much.
I mean, is there any evidence that the coal industry is adding jobs in West Virginia, or is any of that starting to come true?
There is a new mine, and I believe it's a coal mine that opened somewhere within the last 2 months or so, and he has even talked about that, as you know, held that up as an example of how he is sort of helping turn around this industry. But most people think that those efforts are not going to amount to much just because of the shift in our energy consumption in this country.
Darlene Subreville of the Associated Press joins us from Washington. Jean Marbella is here with me in the studio. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap when we come back from a quick break. We'd love to have you join us if you have questions or comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on Monday here on Midday, this month's edition of the Midday Health Watch with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. We hope you can join us for the Midday Health Watch on Monday. If you've just joined us today, as I said, it's the Midday News Wrap. Darlene Subreville joins us on the line from Washington. She covers the White House for the AP. Jean Marbella of the Baltimore Sun is here in Studio A. She has been a feature writer, a national correspondent, and a columnist, covering everything from the Olympics and 9/11 to many, many local events. You are welcome to join our conversation here on the News Wrap. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to find us on Twitter, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, Darlene, you've been at the White House this week. Monday was the first day on the job for General John Kelly as the chief of staff. Do you notice any different vibe, any different feeling around that building and the West Wing in the press briefing room or elsewhere to indicate that General Kelly is having an impact early on?
Well, yes. And the early impact that he had was getting rid of Anthony Scaramucci, who had been named just a few days earlier to be the White House communications director. And then instead of being behind the scenes, as most White House communications directors are, he was very out front on a lot of TV shows, gave this quite interesting interview to Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker. And then after Reince Priebus was dismissed as chief of staff, a weekend passed, and John Kelly was took over and promptly got rid of Anthony Scaramucci. So that was the very first sort of big signal to a lot of us at the White House that, for lack of a better phrase, there was a new sheriff in town, so to speak. We saw General Kelly at a couple of White House events that week. There was a Medal of Honor presentation that President Trump did on Monday. General Kelly was there for that. He traveled to Huntington, West Virginia last night with the president. There have been some reports. One of my colleagues reported that General Kelly also called the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, a couple of days ago to reassure him that his job is safe. As you know, the president in the past couple of weeks went on this sort of public campaign battering Sessions for stepping away, recusing himself from the Russia investigation, and that spawned all these stories and speculation about whether the president wanted to get rid of Jeff Sessions, would he fire him, so on and so forth. But General Kelly stepped in and told him that his job is safe. So he's trying to clamp down on what heretofore had been a lot of the chaos at the White House, so to speak. And this past week so far seems to have been okay.
Attorney General Sessions, along with Dan Coats, the National Intelligence Director, and some others today are holding an event to talk about the leaks of classified information and their stepped-up efforts to put a halt to those. And General Kelly has also mentioned that leaks are a no-no, a big no-no in his book, and he's going to do what he can to quash them. There, people have even raised the specter, Darlene Subreville, of lie detector tests for people in the West Wing. What do you hear about that?
Well, that was Kellyanne Conway this morning, I believe, on Fox and Friends, who she was sort of asked whether it would come to lie detector tests, and she said maybe or maybe not, something to that effect. So they can try, and I'm sure they will try their best to tamp down on some of the leaks, but Washington is just by nature a leaky town. You've got 535 members of Congress running around, plus they have staff people. You have people in the White House that also want to get things out. And some leaks are better than others. You know, you've got trial balloons where ideas are floated to see how they'll be reacted to before they're implemented or not. Some leaks, yes, could be damaging to national security, and I think those are the ones that the White House really wants to clamp down on.
And Jean Marbella, there were two things that came out which weren't supposed to come out this week. One of them was a transcript, two transcripts of phone calls between President Trump and the President of Mexico and the President of Australia back in January, just about a few days after he was inaugurated. It's a fascinating read, those transcripts. Here's Mr. Trump, who had touted himself as the great negotiator, making zero progress with both of his counterparts in Mexico and Australia, and basically, you know, having a really bad ending to both phone calls.
Yeah, and what came across in one of the phone calls was President Trump's concern of how what happened would make him look. And it sort of reinforced to many people's minds that he's still treating the presidency as kind of, you know, a ratings bonanza. How does it look for me, you know, rather than what am I accomplishing? And underneath it all, it was kind of, while it was fascinating to read those transcripts, it was also alarming that they became public. I mean, these are heads of state speaking. These are not assistant
deputy.
This
is classified information.
Right.
Any conversation that a phone call conversation with the president mm-hmm. is classified.
So. Yeah, it's not some assistant deputy to the assistant secretary of transportation talking to his colleague, you know, across town. So, you know, I think leaks, what you call a leak, depends on your political viewpoint, I think. Some leaks are whistleblowing leaks where information that needs to get out to the public gets out. But others like this are rather concerning because you think if you can somehow get your hands on a transcript of what two heads of state are saying, what else can you get your hands on?
Yeah. And Darlene, you're at the White House all the time. Do you have the sense that there are people in the administration on the payroll of the White House, appointed or not, who are out to get the president, because the president and his supporters are suggesting that very thing?
Well, I think the leak of these two transcripts to some degree shows that there is somebody out there. I don't know where they are, and they are alarmed enough at what transpired in the phone calls or just at the president himself and what he's doing, that they're willing to leak this kind of information and risk perhaps being discovered. It doesn't really show a level of loyalty to the president that probably should be there. I've been in D.C. for a while, and I don't remember another leak like this.
Yeah. The other thing that I read that was pretty shocking to me was a transcript of the interview that the Wall Street Journal conducted with the president last week. Jerry Baker, an editor at the Wall Street Journal, did most of the talking. This transcript, the Journal decided not to publish it, and in fact, the president did say in the course of his conversation that this comment or that comment was off the record. But Politico got a hold of it and published it. So whether that's a valid news judgment or not, that's a discussion for a different day. But it's out there. So as I read it, what was scary to me about it, and scary is really the only word I can think to describe it, is that the president did not seem cogent most of the time. I mean, he is a very difficult person to understand when he answers a question because he just bangs around like a pinball in a machine. And is that your experience either speaking directly with the president or with the folks around him? I mean, it just, and I know David Brooks in the New York Times is worried about this publicly. I mean, it just really seems like he does not have a handle on what he means to say or thinks.
Yeah, he has a rather meandering speaking style. I've yet to have the pleasure of a one-on-one conversation with the president, unlike those of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or some others that have interviewed him. But when you read these transcripts of interviews, you do see him ping-ponging from one subject to the next, beginning a thought, trailing off, starting on something else, never finishing the original thought. And you see that, too, in some of his speeches. The other day, he did something at the White House, trying to remember what the event was, but then at the end, it might have been about healthcare, and then at the end, he sort of trails off and starts talking about the stock market. Well, okay.
Yeah.
So that's just the way he is.
Yeah, to try to discern really what the man is saying.
It takes a lot of work to try to pin him down and to get him to answer questions. And one of the things that we talk about in the press corps, for example, when he has a news conference or when there's a foreign leader that comes and they go to the Rose Garden and there's what's known as a two-and-two, where he calls on two reporters from the U.S. press corps and the foreign leader will call on two reporters from his or her press corps. And so we always strategize about questions and what to ask, but you sort of never want to ask the dreaded 4 or 5 part question because you just won't get an answer.
Yeah, yeah. And G. Marbella, we have now lived for 6+ months with a president who makes stuff up all the time. I mean, the level of fabrication and complete he concocts things out of thin air. The Boy Scout phone call is one of them. That's this week. But, this goes way back in his career. I mean, the 3 or 4 million people who allegedly voted illegally for him. There are consequences that are more than just, the fact that he's unsettling the people who didn't vote for him. The 3 or 4 million people who he alleges voted illegally for him has led to this commission on voter fraud. And there are those who say this is a complete waste of money and time and effort because we don't have voter fraud going on at anywhere near the level he thinks is happening. So there are real world consequences for allocation of funds, allocation of resources, allocation of attention here.
Yeah. And what happens, it seems, is we end up spending all our time either verifying or not verifying what he said. And we never get beyond that because then the next day there's another lie. And it's really changed journalism in that in the past, no one ever said the president lied. It would be the president misspoke or the president misunderstood the question. But now people journalists are in the position of outright saying, in a lie, in a falsehood, Trump said X.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. And of course, I didn't mean to say that he alleged they voted for him. He alleged they voted for Secretary Clinton or others, and that's why he didn't win the popular vote. Darlene Superville, do you get the sense that General Kelly is going to be able to sort of rein him in when it comes to these prevarications and often just downright perfidious comments? I mean, there are those who've speculated that General Kelly has taken this job somewhat reluctantly out of a sense of sort of soldierly duty to his country, thinking that this is the thing he can do at this moment. And will that, because that, if that's the case, is he going to be able to rein the president in when it comes to that kind of stuff?
I think the answer to that question is time will tell. General Kelly has only been on the job for 1 week, and that certainly is not enough time to turn around the White House and make it function more effectively in a less chaotic manner. But one of the things that we do know is that General Kelly, all of the White House officials that used to be able to go directly to the president now have to go through General Kelly. So he is acting as...
Including his own daughter, right?
Including his own daughter and son-in-law, yes. So he's acting as a true gatekeeper, sort of managing the flow of information to the president. And in that sense, maybe he will be able to get a handle on the situation there, because there was a period when, again, everybody, there were Oval Office walk-in privileges. The daughter, the son-in-law, other top advisors could just go in and see the president whenever they wanted, give him whatever they wanted. The function of a chief of staff is to sort of be the funnel, be the gatekeeper, and sort of control all of that stuff. So if the president gets better information that General Kelly is vetting better than was being done before, then yes, maybe there will be some more control over the situation.
And Jean Marbella, a Quinnipiac poll, which was released a couple of days ago, says that 62% of those polled thought that the president is clearly not honest. About a third, 33%, approve of his job in office right now. But as we see in the adoring crowds that greeted him in places like Huntington, West Virginia last night, that doesn't seem to be moving the needle very far, although his numbers, 33% is one of the lowest numbers that have polled, and other polls still have him up closer to 39 or 40 even. Given the revelatory information we got through these transcripts where he's talking to the president of Mexico saying, they're going to kill me on this if you don't at least say, you know, that you'll consider paying for it. What do you think these poll numbers are going to do?
You know, the polls are, if I were in Trump's political circle, I would be very concerned about them. But at the same time, you see that despite his dropping numbers, he's still able to get his agenda moving slowly and in fits and starts. But when you look at what he's doing through the agencies, like the immigration initiatives that he's been announcing, where he wants to curtail even legal immigration, you don't have to be popular to do that. And you see that also in, you know, any number of areas that are of interest to him. You look at in Baltimore, of interest to us, of course, is the consent decree that was agreed to under the previous administration. But it's clear that under Sessions, that decree, they tried to delay it unsuccessfully, but it feels like they're going to be dragging their heels, even though it's a legally signed agreement. So in many ways, polls affect elections, obviously, but the running of the government, he can continue to do that.
And Darlene, when it comes to polls, The Economist had a poll earlier this week about people who distrust the media. And among Republicans, some 70% of Republicans trust what Mr. Trump says more, they say in this poll, than they trust what they read in the New York Times, the Washington Post, see on CNN, or even read in publications like the National Review. And I would assume that the AP is part of that mix as well. So there's still enormous distrust of the media in favor of believing what the president says. How does that impact the job that you're doing and all of your colleagues at the White House day after day?
Well, we're just, you know, doing our jobs, trying to go out, report the facts, provide context, help people understand what the president wants to do on any particular issue, be it health care, immigration, the budget, and just try to let our work speak for itself. The quality of our work speak for itself. I'm not surprised at the number that you cited, just based on the whole, just go back to the election campaign from last year and the drumbeat of fake news and that sort of thing. And, you know, you've got the president out there talking about the Russia investigation as a hoax and a fabricated story. It's not surprising that his people believe that, but the facts are that people associated with the president did meet with Russians, did talk to the Russian ambassador. The president's son had a meeting with a Russian lawyer to talk about getting negative information on Hillary Clinton. So those things aren't fake.
Yeah. I'm interested in the president's clear anger about the failure of the Senate to pass the health care bill. interested in the sense that this is a very unpopular bill. I mean, this one and the bill that the Congress did pass were polling at under 20%, somewhere mm-hmm. around 17 or 18%. So had he gotten this legislative win, did they really have the expectation that that legislative win was going to translate into a populist win?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, because you got to wonder. I mean, just, you know, there. I mean, if Trump had gotten his way, he'd gotten his way.
Yeah.
But a whole lot of his voters would have been disenfranchised out of the healthcare system.
Exactly.
And you just got to wonder how long term that.
Before they realize that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it really is fascinating. You talked about General Kelly assuring Jeff Sessions that he's going to have a job for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that the Department of Justice is doing, including looking into alleged discrimination against white applicants in college admissions. And as a sort of a sidebar to that, we've got Asian American students suing Harvard University basically over the same the same issue. Darlene, what do you hear from the White House about that that particular path that the DOJ is going down when it comes to college admissions?
Actually, not much. The question about that came up in one of the White House briefings we had earlier this week, and there was not much of a response on it. I think the answer was they referred us back to the Justice Department on it, and they also said that the story was based on some sort of internal personnel memo that had been leaked again, and that they didn't want to comment on some sort of a leaked document.
Mm-hmm. And under normal circumstances, Darlene, wouldn't it make sense that the president would embrace that kind of thing? That seems to be the kind of red meat to his base that's right up there with curbing legal immigration. But, I mean, does it say anything about the still strained relationship between Mr. Trump and Mr. Sessions, given that Mr. Trump has not sort of jumped on this bandwagon?
That's another good question. You know, Sessions has said that he wants to stay at the Justice Department, and, you know, I just mentioned that General Kelly told him that his job is safe for the foreseeable future. And so he is going about the business of the Justice Department and trying to carry out what he thinks the president wants. So I suspect at some point maybe we'll hear the president come out and talk about this a little bit more, because it is the kind of issue that will fire up the people that support him. But I don't have any insight into when that will be.
Darlene Superville is a White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Darlene, we're going to let you go. I know you got a busy day ahead, like all these days around in a job that you have covering the White House. But I very much appreciate your time this afternoon, and we look forward to our paths crossing again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We will be back after a break with Jean Marbella. She is part of the Baltimore Sun's investigative team. By the way, you can look for a story about Mayor Catherine Pugh in this Sunday's Sun that Jean wrote with her colleagues at the Sun. We're going to talk about Catherine Pugh. We're going to talk about the police department. We're going to talk about stuff having to do with the news stories that were pertinent to Baltimore when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. Drop us an email at midday@wypr.org. Whatever you do, don't change that dial.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you'd like to join us there, @MiddayTomHall. Jean Marbella joins me here in Studio A. She is a longtime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, currently serving on their investigative team. Jean, let's talk about a few things going on here in Charm City. Let's begin by listening to a little bit of what Mayor Pugh had to say a couple of days ago on WBAL radio about her plan to confront the tremendous uptick in violence that we've experienced over the last couple of years.
What people don't understand is the number of resources that have been provided because he's reached out. We have ATF, DEA,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Homeland Security, FBI, all are in here. But we also have a relationship with the Department of Justice. And so with that assistance, what we've been able to do is look around the nation and say, what's working? What's working in terms of violence reduction? And so we've determined, with their help, that the best strategy that has been sustainable over the past 5 years is what has happened in Los Angeles.
So we don't have a plan from the mayor written down. Several people have expressed great frustration at that. Brandon Scott, the councilman who heads the Public Safety Committee on the Baltimore City Council, very preemptively stopped a meeting because the Pew administration was not able to deliver him a PowerPoint presentation. He has delivered his own plan for fighting crime. Build Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, a very active community organization, held a protest just a couple of nights ago demanding that the mayor release a plan. What do you think the holdup is on her end?
You know, there's something of a fetish about this crime-solving plan. You know, it's kind of charming that people think that if you just get the right words down on a piece of paper, you're going to fix a problem that is generations deep in Baltimore. But I think what people are talking about when they talk about the plan is they're talking about a vision. You know, as I mentioned, the crime has been in Baltimore at alarming levels for many years now, and it's systemic. There are many reasons for it. And I think what people want to see from Pew is her vision. They want to see action. They want to see her just do something, try anything to curtail the homicide rate, the armed robberies on the street. And I think many people are getting impatient because it may just be her style, but she seems very calm, which is good. You don't want her, you know, running around with her head on fire. But people don't see anything changing. They don't see any new idea, any vision on how we're ever going to get off this horrible, you know, wheel that we're on, where every day there's another couple of homicides.
It's perhaps she is, in fact, delivering on her promise of having better relations with Annapolis and perhaps even better relationships with the federal government. Although, as you mentioned in the previous segment, Jeff Sessions, you know, and the current Department of Justice may be dragging their feet when it comes to enforcing the consent decree to the extent that they're even able to do that now that it's under the supervision of a judge. But, you know, she has a better relationship with Governor Hogan, certainly, than her predecessor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. I think that's pretty clear. Do you think that, she is, in fact, being measured about this? She's basically saying, don't rush me. We're thinking about this. We're talking to these agencies. She mentions Los Angeles. I mean, is she finding places around the country that can serve as direct paradigms for Baltimore?
Right. That's always, this is who the people elected. This is someone who's made her career on building connections, whether it's to other legislators, to other branches of government. That's always been her thing. And I think there's merit to that. But by the same token, I think the sense of urgency that people want to see is just missing. And people are just, they're tired of, you know, being worried to walk down their street, to walk their dog. They're worried, you know, they're just tired of always looking over their shoulder.
The police department has now been accused not once but twice of planting evidence in criminal cases. Kevin Davis came out yesterday, I guess it was, very strongly defending the police, saying don't jump to conclusions about these videotapes, the police cameras that, you know, tapes have been made public by public defenders. Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, has dropped dozens of cases involving some of these officers who are alleged to have planted evidence. You know, with all the drug dealing going on in the city of Baltimore, you'd think that the police wouldn't have to plant any evidence. There's plenty of drugs that are there on their own accord. But what does this do to in the context of the consent decree, in the context of people's need for urgency, as you say, to address the crime problem?
Really, I've heard everywhere you go in town, you just hear people talking about those body cam images because it's just so stark. And it reinforces for many people what resulted in the consent decree, that investigation into the practices of the police department, where they found numerous instances of police just, you know, running roughshod over people's constitutional rights, just strip searching people in public, you know, just grabbing people off the street, you know, with no charges. And this just seems of a piece with it. And you think, well, there's this decree where we're supposed to be working on reforming those practices that were uncovered by the Department of Justice. And yet every day there's a revelation of, you know, drugs being planted, or there were those.
The elite unit.
Right. Yeah. And that also resulted in a lot of cases getting dropped. And so here are possibly legitimate cases, but those people are going free to do what? To commit more crime in the city.
Yeah, putatively. This, of course, comes in the context of a conversation about a bill recommending, of all things, mandatory minimum sentences, after we've spent a decade or so bashing the idea of taking that prerogative away from judges and putting it in, you know, giving them individual authority to take each case as it comes. We've got this sort of strange specter of two African-American leaders, Jack Young, the president of the city council, and Mayor Pugh, endorsing a plan that the police commissioner also endorses, that says, no, if you're caught with a gun, you are immediately, you have no chance of parole and a minimum sentence of a year. Where does that stand? It changed a little bit in committee. Where do you think that's going to end up?
I believe it got weakened, and it just reflects, I think, this sort of breakdown in the criminal justice system. Like the police officers will say, well, we're arresting people, but then the state's attorney can't seem to get convictions. And then the state's attorney's office will say, well, you know, judges aren't sentencing these people to the amount of time they need to be sentenced. Everyone's getting off on probation. So it's like every piece of the criminal justice system seems not to be working as intended. And to create a law that tells judges you must give a year's sentence to someone, you know, with a gun, it just seems ludicrous. I mean, that's what judges are supposed to do anyway. And why would a city council telling a judge to sentence someone to a certain amount of time change what's been going on already?
And of course, we're talking about, you know, prosecuting for illegal guns, not for guns that are registered. One last thing before we let you go. The Justice Department did send a letter to the city of Baltimore, Police Commissioner Davis, as well as three or four other cities around the country, expressing great displeasure with so-called sanctuary cities and so-called police departments not cooperating with ICE officials. Here's in the context of the mayor trying to, you know, make the Justice Department a partner in these efforts. Was that a step backwards in that regard?
And, you know, Mayor Pugh has walked a fine line here. I think she has said, we're not a sanctuary city, but we kind of behave as one. And it's Baltimore, since the previous administration, has always been friendly to immigrants. You know, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake believed that she wanted immigrants to come to town. With so many people fleeing to the suburbs, she saw immigrants as part of what would build Baltimore for the future. And when you see, you know, Trump's plan to curtail even legal immigration, it seems to go against what most, you know, what mayors such as the current and the previous one, as well as many economists, believe, that immigrants improve an economy. You know, they free the low-level workforce to get higher paid jobs, and they create more economy. You know, we sell things to them. We rent houses to them.
Yeah.
So it just goes against what Baltimore has been embracing.
Well, Jean Marbella, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Look forward to the Peace in the Sun on Sunday, and have a great weekend.
Thanks very much. You too.
Jean Marbella is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday on Midday, this month's edition of the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City. Hope you can join us then. By the way, looking a little further ahead next week on Tuesday, we're going to spend the hour with Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Our senior producer is Rob Sivak. Our producers are Bridget Armstrong and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our interns are Xandra Ellen, Roland Hugh, and Jen Schultz. We want to thank Marie-Louise Bistro for lunch today. They're located on Charles Street in Mount Vernon. They specialize in a blend of French, Italian, and Mediterranean cuisines. They're open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, or dinner with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Menu and reservations at MarieLouiseBistroCatering.com. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.